The Moon Pool by A. Merritt. Chapter 17. The Leprechaun. The shell carried us straight back to the house of Yalara. Larry was awaiting me. We stood again before the tenebrous wall where first we had faced the priestess and the voice. And as we stood, again the portal appeared with all its disconcerting magical abruptness. But now the scene was changed. Around the jet table were grouped a number of figures. Lugor, Yalara beside him, seven others. All of them fair-haired, and all men, save one who sat at the left of the priestess, an old, old woman. How old, I could not tell. Her face bearing traces of a beauty that must once have been as great as Yalara's own, but now ravaged, in some way awesome. Through its ruins, the fearful, malicious gaiety shining out like a spirit of joy held within a corpse. Began, then, our examination, for such it was. And as it progressed, I was more and more struck by the change in the O'Keefe. All flippancy was gone. Rarely did his sense of humor reveal itself in any of his answers. He was like a cautious swordsman, fencing, guarding, studying his opponent. Or rather, like a chess player who keeps sensing some far-reaching purpose in the game. Alert, contained, watchful. Always he stressed the power of our surface races, their multitudes, their solidarity. Their questions were myriad. What were our occupations? Our system of government? How great were the waters, the land? Intensely interested were they in the World War, querying minutely into its causes, its effects. In our weapons, their interest was avid, and they were exceedingly minute in their examination of us as to the ruins which had excited our curiosity, their position and surroundings, and if others than ourselves might be expected to find and pass through their entrance. At this I shot a glance at Lugor. He did not seem unduly interested. I wondered if the Russian had told him as yet of the girl of the rosy wall of the Moon Pool Chamber, and the real reasons for our search. Then I answered as briefly as possible, omitting all reference to these things. The Red Dwarf watched me with unmistakable amusement, and I knew Morakinov had told him. But clearly Lugor had kept his information even from Yalara, and as clearly she had spoken to none of that episode when O'Keefe's automatic had shattered the Keth-smitten vase. Again I felt that sense of deep bewilderment, of helpless search for clue to all the tangle. For 2 hours we were questioned, and then the priestess called Rador and let us go. Larry was somber as we returned. He walked about the room uneasily. "Hell's brewing here, all right," he said at last, stopping before me. "I can't make out just the particular brand. That's all that bothers me. We're going to have a stiff fight, that's sure. What I want to do quick is to find the Golden Girl, Doc. Haven't seen her on the wall lately, have you?" he queried, hopefully fantastic. "Laugh if you want to," he went on, "but she's our best bet. It's going to be a race between her and the O'Keefe Banshee, but I put my money on her." "I had a queer experience while I was in that garden after you'd left." His voice grew solemn. "Did you ever see a leprechaun, Doc?" I shook my head again, as solemnly. "He's a little man in green," said Larry. "Oh, about as high as your knee. I saw one once in Carntor Woods. And as I sat there, half asleep in Yalara's garden, the living spit of him stepped out from one of those bushes, twirling a little shillelagh. It "It's a tight box you're getting in, Larry Avick," said he. "But don't you be downhearted, lad." "I'm carrying on," said I. "But you're a long way from Ireland," I said. Or I thought I did. "You've a lot of friends there," he answered. "And where the heart rests, the feet are swift to follow. Not that I'm saying I'd like to live here, Larry," said he. "I know where my heart is now," I told him. "It rests on a girl with golden eyes and the hair and swan-white breast of Ailie the Fair. But me feet don't seem to get to her," I said. The brogue thickened. And the little man in green nodded his head and whirled his shillelagh. "It's what I came to tell you," says he. "Don't you fall for the Van Iver, the serpent woman with the blue eyes. She's a daughter of Ivor, lad. And don't you do nothing to make the brown-haired colleen ashamed of you, Larry O'Keefe. I knew your great-great-grandfather and his before him, Aroon," says he. "And one of the O'Keefe failings is to think their hearts big enough to hold all the women of the world. A heart's built to hold only one permanently, Larry," he says. "And I'm warning you, a nice girl don't like to move into a place all cluttered up with another's washing and mending and cooking and other things pertaining to general wife work. Not that I think the blue-eyed one is keen for mending and cooking," says he. "You don't have to be coming all this way to tell me that," I answer. "Well, I'm just a-telling you," he says. "You've got some rough knocks coming, Larry. In fact, you're in for a devil of a time. But remember that you're the O'Keefe," says he. "And while the boys are all with you, Bick, you gotta be on the job yourself." "I hope," I tell him, "that the O'Keefe Banshee can find her way here in time. That is, if it's necessary, which I hope it won't be." "Don't you worry about that," says he. "Not that she's keen on leaving the old sod, Larry. The good old soul's in quite a state of mind about you, Aroon. I don't mind telling you, lad, that she's mobilizing all the clan, and if she has to come for you, Avick, they'll be with her, and they'll sweep this joint clean before you go. What they'll do to it'll make the big wind look like a summer breeze on Loughlin. And that's about all, Larry. We thought a voice from the Green Isle would cheer you. Don't forget that you're the O'Keefe, and I say it again, all the boys are with you. But we want to keep being proud of you, lad." And I looked again, and there was only a bush waving. There wasn't a smile in my heart, or if there was, it was a very tender one. "I'm going to bed," he said abruptly. "Keep an eye on the wall, Doc." Between the seven sleeps that followed, Larry and I saw but little of each other. Yolara sought him more and more. Thrice we were called before the council. Once we were at a great feast, whose splendors and surprises I can never forget. Largely I was in the company of Rador. Together, we two passed the green barriers into the dwelling-place of the Ladala. They seemed provided with everything needful for life, but everywhere was an oppressiveness, a gathering together of hate, that was spiritual rather than material, as tangible as the latter, and far, far more menacing. "They do not like to dance with the Shining One," was Rador's constant and only reply to my efforts to find the cause. Once I had concrete evidence of the mood. Glancing behind me, I saw a white, vengeful face peer from behind a tree trunk, a hand lift, a shining dart speed from it straight toward Rador's back. Instinctively, I thrust him aside. He turned upon me angrily. I pointed to where the little missile lay, still quivering on the ground. He gripped my hand. "That someday I will repay," he said. I looked again at the thing. At its end was a tiny cone, covered with a glistening gelatinous substance. Rador pulled from a tree beside us a fruit somewhat like an apple. Look, he said. He dropped it upon the dart. And at once, before my eyes, in less than 10 seconds, the fruit had rotted away. That's what would have happened to Rador, but for you, friend, he said. Come now between this and the prelude to the latter half of the drama, whose history this narrative is. Only scattering and necessarily fragmentary observations. First, the nature of the ebon opacities, blocking out the spaces between the pavilion pillars or covering their tops like roofs. These were magnetic fields, light absorbers, negativing the vibrations of radiance. Literally, screens of electric force, which formed as impervious a barrier to light as would have screens of steel. They instantaneously made night appear in a place where no night was, but they interposed no obstacle to air or to sound. They were extremely simple in their inception, no more miraculous than is glass, which, inversely, admits the vibrations of light, but shuts out those coarser ones we call air. And partly those others which produce upon our auditory nerves the effects we call sound. Briefly, their mechanism was this. For the same reason that Dr. Goodwin's exposition of the mechanism of the atomic engines was deleted, his description of the light-destroying screens has been deleted by the Executive Council. JBF, President, IA of S. There were two favored classes of the Ladala, the soldiers and the dream-makers. The dream-makers were the most astonishing social phenomena, I think, of all. Denied by their circumscribed environment the wider experiences of us of the outer world, the Murians had perfected an amazing system of escape through the imagination. They were, too, intensely musical. Their favorite instruments were double flutes, immensely complex pipe organs, harps, great and small. They had another remarkable instrument made up of a double octave of small drums, which gave forth percussions remarkably disturbing to the emotional centers. It was this love of music that gave rise to one of the few truly humorous incidents of our caverned life. Larry came to me. It was just after our fourth sleep, I remember. "Come on to a concert," he said. We skimmed off to one of the bridge garrisons. Rador called the 20 guards to attention. And then, to my utter stupefaction, the whole company, O'Keefe leading them, roared out the anthem, "God Save the King." They sang, in a closer approach to the English than might have been expected, scores of miles below England's level. "Send him victorious, happy and glorious," they bellowed. He quivered with suppressed mirth at my paralysis of surprise. "Taught him that for Marakinoff's benefit," he gasped. "Wait till that Red hears it! He'll blow up!" "Just wait until you hear Yolara lisp, a pretty little thing I taught her," said Larry, as we set back for what we now called home. There was an impish twinkle in his eye. And I did hear. For it was not many minutes later that the priestess condescended to command me to come to her with O'Keefe.
"Show Goodwin how much you have learned of our speech, O lady of the lips of honeyed flame," murmured Larry.
She hesitated, smiled at him, and then, from that perfect mouth, out of the exquisite throat, in the voice that was like the chiming of little silver bells, she trilled a melody familiar to me indeed.
She's only a bird in a gilded cage, a beautiful sight to see.
And so on to the bitter end. She thinks it's a love song, said Larry when he had left. It's only part of a repertoire I'm teaching her. Honestly, Doc, it's the only way I can keep my mind clear when I'm with her, he went on earnestly. She's a deviless from hell. But a wonder. Whenever I find myself going, I get her to sing that, or Take Back Your Gold, or some other ancient lay, and I'm back again pronto with the right perspective. Pop goes all the mystery. Hell, I say, she's only a woman. End of chapter 17.